This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The night sky for April 2011. Over the last few months, I've been recommending a few books to help you find your way around the sky. Jenny Gupta, who is one of the Jodcast team, has just come back from India, and in a bookshop she found a little book, not that expensive, called Pocket Guide to Stars and Planets. It's actually a book that I wrote about 7 years ago now. It's only about £10 from Amazon, so it's not too expensive. But it treats the North and Southern Hemisphere equally, in that the quarterly star charts, the two of them, North and Southern Hemisphere, and it includes details about 50 of the best astronomical objects to observe in the whole of the sky. So it doesn't ignore the Southern Hemisphere. In fact, that book's been quite popular in places like Australia and New Zealand, just because of that. Those 50 objects I call the astronomical A-list. I believe it's just been translated to Spanish, actually. So if you are interested in quite a cheap little book to help you find your way around, then Amazon has it for around the £10 mark. Okay, well, what can we see in the sky? Well, that lovely region with Orion, Taurus, and Gemini are now setting towards the west as evening falls. And reasonably high in the south is the constellation of Leo the Lion, one that actually looks a little bit like what it might be. I think of those lions in Trafalgar Square on their haunches. The brightest star, basically his front knees, is called Regulus. And the sickle, sort of a back-to-front question mark, sometimes called a sickle, makes up his mane and his head. There's a nice region of fairly bright galaxies just below his nether regions. And with a telescope, if you actually align it on Regulus and sweep gently eastwards, you should perhaps come across them. Just to the rear of Leo, between Virgo and Coma Berenices, two fairly faint constellations, in fact Virgo has got a bright star Spica in it, is what we call the realm of the galaxies, where there are lots and lots of galaxies, many of them in the Messier catalogue, and these are ones that you can see given a good, clear, dark, transparent sky with a relatively small telescope. As we'll see, Saturn is currently in Virgo. A fairly bright star is up to the left, and that's Arcturus in Bootes. And above Leo, looking fairly high in the sky, is the constellation of Ursa Major, the Great Bear, with, of course, the stars making up what we call the plough, the Americans call the Big Dipper. If you've got a small telescope, have a look at the middle star of the three that make up the handle. That's actually a double star, Alcor and Mizar. But if you look in detail, you'll see that Mizar is itself a double. So it looks rather good. And there's a fourth little star in the field of view as well. So that's a nice thing to spot. So perhaps not the most dynamic sky in the evening. Of course, as the night passes on, then we get the stars Vega in Lyra, Deneb in Cygnus beginning to rise, and they will basically form part of what's called the summer triangle with the star Altair in the constellation the Eagle. So not a bad time to observe, and of course we have to wait up a little bit later at the present time in order to do so. Well, what about the planets? Well, Jupiter passes behind the Sun on April the 6th. That's called Superior Conjunction. So obviously you won't see it in the early part of April. But at the very end of April, it will rise shortly before the Sun, and you might be able to glimpse it with binoculars just above the eastern horizon. Its magnitude will then be about minus 2.1, angular size about 33 arc seconds. It's not really the best month to observe it, but I'll come back to it in a highlight towards the end. Well, what about Saturn? This is really one of the two best months to observe Saturn in its current apparition. It's now an evening object rising before sunset at the beginning of April. It actually reaches opposition on the night of April the 3rd, 4th. That means it'll be due south at about 12 midnight universal time. So that means it's highest in the sky. You haven't got to wait up too long to observe it well. And I observed it from the Isle of Wight recently, and I could make out Cassini's division, which is quite a nice thing to see. The magnitude is about plus 0.4. Its brightness decreases a touch to plus 0.5. That's actually because the rings, surprisingly, although they're generally now opening out from being almost edge-on a year or so ago, they're basically, because of the Earth's motion, closing slightly this month from about 8.8 degrees to the line of sight, dropping down to 7.8 during the month. There's a plus sign there that actually indicates that we're seeing the northern hemisphere. And the rings span an angular size of 44 arc seconds, which is about double the planet's disk. As well as seeing the Cassini division, a small telescope should easily show you Titan, which is Saturn's brightest moon, and given good conditions, other moons as well. Mercury. Well, Mercury passes in front of the Sun on the 9th of April. That's called inferior conjunction, so you're not going to see it then. But again, rather like Jupiter, it reappears in the dawn very low down in the east with a magnitude of plus 0.9. And again, I'll come back to that towards the end. Well, Mars has now passed behind the Sun and emerges in the pre-dawn sky towards the middle of April. The trouble is the ecliptic seen in the morning in the east is at a very shallow angle to the horizon. So even though its angle from the Sun is increasing, it still has a very low elevation. You'll need a good low eastern horizon and a pair of binoculars. Obviously, make sure you don't use your binoculars once the Sun has risen. This month, it has a magnitude of plus 1.2, reasonably bright, an angular size of just 4 arc seconds, so you're not going to see any details. And again, we'll come back to that at the very, very end. Well, Venus has been a wonderful pre-dawn object shining brightly in the sky before dawn. Magnitude of minus 3.9, that means it's pretty bright. It's the brightest thing you can see in the sky, save for the moon. So that's not a bad thing to look for. Again, it's not that high now above the eastern horizon because of the angle of the ecliptic to the horizon. As it's moving, as it is, towards the far side of the Sun, its angular size is reducing. It drops from 13.2 arc seconds down to 11.7 during the month. And you might think, well, that will mean it becomes less bright. Of course, as it does so, more of that visible disk is being illuminated by the Sun. So in fact, the actual apparent magnitude stays constant. Okay, well, there are the planets. Let's just finally have a look at some of the highlights of the month. Well, I've already mentioned that Saturn is really coming to its best time. It's in the constellation Virgo. The rings now 8 degrees from the line of sight, on average are now opening out, but it won't be until 2016 that they'll be at their widest again. So each year we'll have a better look of the ring system of Saturn. You should, with a small telescope, and I was able to the other day, see some of the bands on the surface and easily show, as I said, Titan. If you've looked at Saturn with a small telescope, move just a little bit to the right, because it's not far from the star Gamma Virginis in Virgo. It's called Porrima. Porrima is a double star. It's made up of two identical stars, each of magnitude 3.5. Now, way back in 1919, they were separated by 6 arc seconds, very easy to split into two with a small telescope. But by about 2005, we say it's at periastron, the pair was so close they could barely be split. But they're now opening out again, and this month they should be 1.7 arc seconds apart, which means that given good seeing, which means that the atmosphere is not too turbulent, with a small telescope, you should be able to show that there are actually two stars there and not one. So, when you've looked at Saturn, why not look at Porrima? After sunset on April the 5th, you have a chance of seeing what is called, the old moon in the new moon's arms. And you may see, if it's clear, a very thin, two-day-old crescent moon low in the west. Assuming, as is quite usual, there's a fair bit of cloud cover on the Earth, then so-called Earthshine will light up the remainder of the moon's surface, and you'll see it very faintly. Binoculars should show it to you pretty well. If you care to put night sky, either as one word or two, into Google, you'll come to the night sky page that I write for the Jodrell Bank website each month. And I've actually included an image that I took of the old moon in the new moon's arms precisely 1 month earlier, when there was a two-day-old moon. I took one image exposed for the new moon and a much longer image exposed for the old moon, and I've actually combined them together into one. And it's not a bad picture. I'm quite pleased. I've never seen anything quite like it. So have a look at that, perhaps. If you're looking at the moon with a telescope, one thing to look for, April the 11th is actually a good night, is called the Alpine Valley. There are some mountains, the Apennines, that run around the edge of Mare Imbrium. They go up to a rather nice, very circular, not surprising, but dark crater called Plato. And if you look at the mountains just to the right of Plato, as seen in the sky, perhaps not upside down, then you should see a cleft, and that's called the Alpine Valley. It's about 7 miles wide, 7 to 9 miles long. And in fact, in a really, really good image, you can see a thin rill that runs along its length. That's quite a challenge to observe. I've never actually seen it. But over the next couple of nights, the dark crater Plato and the young crater Copernicus will come into view. It's a very interesting part of the moon to observe. We do have a meteor shower this month. They're called the Lyrids. It's the night of the 22nd and 23rd of April. To be frank, it's not one of the best of the meteor showers. Typically, you only see perhaps 15 per hour, but they have been seen for at least 2,600 years, and they're actually dust particles that come from the comet Thatcher. But that was discovered in 1861, so it's nothing to do with our Prime Minister in the past. Occasionally, we actually pass through a fairly dense clump of particles. It happened in 1982, and there was a pretty good shower with about over 90 meteors seen. So it's worth having a look at. Sadly this year, the peak of activity on the night of the 22nd, 23rd of April is only a couple of days or so after the full moon. So that doesn't help. But I have looked, and the moon is pretty low in the south. So I think by the time that you really want to have a good look, which is sort of about 2 o'clock in the morning, when Lyra, Vega are high in the sky, you may have a chance of seeing them. And finally, at the very end of the month, I keep referring to a highlight to do with all these planets. Okay, we can see Saturn in the evening, but we would have a chance on the last two mornings of the month, the 29th and the 30th, to see four planets lined up in the pre-dawn sky along with a crescent moon. And again, I've given a little picture of that on the Night Sky website. You'll certainly need binoculars, and Jupiter will only just be above the horizon, but of course that's relatively bright. Mars is very close to Jupiter, and then you've got Mercury and Venus. So you can see four planets and a crescent moon together. That's going to be a tough one to photograph if it's clear. I shall certainly have a try, because it could be a very nice photograph. So, a fair number of things to look for this month. I do wish you well.
Thanks for that, Ian. So now for the Southern Sky, we have John Field.
Welcome to the April Jodcast from Carter Observatory in Wellington, New Zealand. Autumn has arrived in the Southern Hemisphere. Over the last month, our daylight hours have continued to get shorter as we pass the autumnal equinox, and will continue to do so until the time of the winter solstice in June. One advantage of the longer nighttime hours means we can start our stargazing at a much more reasonable time. Low after twilight in the west, with Oni's head marked by the V-shaped cluster called the Hyades, and with the bright foreground star Aldebaran marking one of his eyes, is Taurus the Bull. The Pleiades marking the back of the bull will be lost in the twilight sky during April and will not appear until the morning sky in June, around the time of the Southern Hemisphere winter solstice. One of the zodiac constellations, Taurus sits along the path that the Sun, the Moon and the planets move along as observed from Earth. The Sun will move in front of the background stars of Taurus during a period from May the 13th to the 21st of June. The less bright of the two eyes, Epsilon Tauri, was discovered in 2007 to have a planet 7 times the mass of Jupiter and with an orbital period of 1.4 Earth years, orbiting it. There are 20 stars brighter than magnitude 5 in our night sky known to have planets orbiting them. A number of these are visible in our southern night sky. The neighbouring zodiac constellation Gemini's second brightest star, Pollux, shining at magnitude 1.15, also hosts a planet, estimated at 2.7 times that of Jupiter. Only slightly fainter than Pollux is the bright star Thaumihol, the mouth of the fish in the constellation Pisces Astranus, the southern fish. The star is known to have at least one planet orbiting it. This planet was the first to be directly imaged by the Hubble Space Telescope in 2008. There is a disk of debris orbiting around the star, and it's possible that other planets may be forming within this disk. Gemini is home to the open star cluster M35. This open cluster is about the same size as a full moon, and at magnitude 5.3 should be visible to the unaided eye from a dark location, and easily seen in binoculars or a small telescope. The cluster is estimated to be 2,800 light-years away and consists of over 300 stars covering an area of 24 light-years. Gemini represents the heavenly twins Castor and Pollux, who travel with Jason and the Argonauts on his quest to discover the Golden Fleece. As Taurus sets in the west, our winter constellation Scorpius rises in the east. The brightest star in Scorpius is Antares, the rival of Mars, shining at magnitude 1. Depending on the list, it is either the 15th or the 16th brightest star in the night sky. Antares is a red supergiant star about 600 light-years away and has a diameter of up to 800 times that of our Sun. It is estimated to be 65,000 times brighter and with a mass of up to 18 times greater. Although the core of the star is many times hotter than our star, the Sun, due to the expansion of its atmosphere, the surface has dropped to a much cooler temperature, giving it a reddish hue. This colour gave its name, the rival of Mars. Antares is a binary star system, and the companion, although bright at magnitude 5.5, is difficult to observe due to the brightness of Antares. Normally a telescope of 150mm or 6 inches is needed to observe the companion. But occasionally the moon can occult Antares, and this can allow smaller telescopes to observe this star whilst Antares is hidden. Some observers report it as having a green tint, but this is due to an optical illusion as the star is actually a blue supergiant. To Māori in Aotearoa, New Zealand, Antares is known as Rehua, and it marks the eye of Te Mata o Māui, the hook of Māui. The curve of the scorpion's body and stinger are seen as the curve of the hook, and the distinctive triangle made by the stinger becomes the tip of the hook. In Māori mythology, this was the hook that Māui, a great hero, used to pull the North Island of New Zealand up out of the ocean. The North Island of New Zealand is known as Te Ika of Māui, the fish of Māui. The hook crosses a wide and bright part of the galaxy, and it's in this region that we look directly towards the centre of our Milky Way, 30,000 light-years away. With such a high concentration of stars, this region is a prime area for observing gravitational microlensing events. A microlensing event is based on the gravitational lens effect. A massive object, the lens, will bend the light of a bright background object, the source, and this can generate multiple distorted, magnified, and brightened images of the background source. As the two objects move into alignment, a bell-shaped light curve is formed. If a planet orbits around the lensing star, then an additional peak will appear on the curve. A collaborative team of astronomers from New Zealand and Japan are running a microlensing program at Mount John Observatory above Lake Tekapo in the central South Island of New Zealand. Using a 1.8-metre telescope and a wide-field CCD camera, they study the dense regions around the sky on a regular basis to spot the slight change in brightness that may herald a lensing event. Once a potential event is observed, a wide group of amateur and professional astronomers are notified, and they can follow the light curve. This potentially allows 24 hours of observation of the event, and means a short period peak of a planet can be observed. To date, 14 stars in Scorpius have been discovered to have planets orbiting them, but all are much fainter than magnitude 5. In our evening sky, we have only one planet visible. Rising in the east is the planet Saturn. Sitting in the constellation of Virgo, Saturn appears as a bright yellow star. The most distant of the visible planets, Saturn takes about 30 years to complete one orbit around our star, the Sun. Named after the father of the gods in Greek mythology, it is sometimes associated with Cronus, the father of time. The rings surrounding Saturn are visible in small telescopes with a magnification of 20 times or greater. The first person to observe the rings was Galileo in 1610. Today the rings are known to be made mostly of water ice with small amounts of other materials. Although the rings are very wide, they are in fact very thin, currently estimated to be 20 meters thick. The rings are made of a large number of individual rings, and some of these areas are denser or thinner than others. The gaps between some rings are due to the interaction of the gravitational pull of Saturn, its moons, and material within the rings themselves. Saturn has a similar axial tilt to the Earth, and so it experiences seasons. An effect of this tilt is that the rings sometimes appear as a thin ring surrounding the planet, or at other times they may appear tilted and far more open. This tilting of the rings alters the brightness of the planet and its appearance in a telescope. Saturn's largest moon, Titan, also visible on a small telescope, was discovered in 1655 by Christian Huygens. This moon is similar in size to Mercury, but is about half the mass. Titan is surrounded by a dense atmosphere of nitrogen, methane, and hydrogen. This composition is similar to what we think the Earth's atmosphere was like after it formed. Venus is still visible in our morning sky as the morning star. The other bright planets, though, are still too close to the Sun to be easily seen. Many thanks for listening into our Jodcast, and we hope you have clear skies and great observing.